Empire Lines uncovers the unexpected, often two-way, flows of empires through art. Interdisciplinary thinkers use individual artworks as artifacts of imperial exchange, revealing the how and why of the monolith empire.
Freud Museum, and it does go back to a Van Gogh exhibition I curated in 1980, but they didn't like what I said, so I got silenced from the Van Gogh mythology because I challenged history.
In this episode, art historian and professor Griselda Pollock traces the memories of contemporary artist women like Shutapa Biswas, one of her students in the 1980s, and the entanglements of feminist, queer, and post-colonial thinking in art schools and universities.
My name is Griselda Pollock, and I'm professionally an art historian, but I've been making exhibitions for many, many years. But this is the first time I was invited to curate an exhibition in London. The exhibition is called Medium and Memory, and the principle of the exhibition is to take all the wonderful legacies of the modernist moment, where artists explored every dimension of art making that was possible in the medium. At the same time, I'm proposing that the world crashed in on artists in the postmodern moment, where they felt called upon to speak of the world that had been exiled by modernists in the focus on their fidelity to medium. They didn't lose their potential of the medium, accumulating histories of trauma as well as personal histories in producing works that are charged with pathos and affect that comes through the actual way in which they've worked with their medium.
Griselda, you were born in South Africa, but you've practiced across the world, and you're Professor Emerita of Social and Critical Histories of Art at the University of Leeds. As we sit at the centre of Medium and Memory, we're surrounded by stills from Lumen, a film produced by an artist called Shutapa Biswas, who was one of few artists of colour who attended and who you taught at Leeds in the 80s. Can you tell me about when you first met Shutapa and how she as a student influenced your practice as a teacher?
Absolutely. It's one of the longest relationships I've had with any student. Shutapa was born in Santikirtan, which is one of the great cultural centres of the Indian cultural transformation at the beginning of the century. So it's now a UNESCO heritage site. It's in Bengal, near where Calcutta is now. Came here when she was about five as a little girl, fostered by older siblings, all of whom were scientists and an intellectual and very, very supportive father. So she also had a journey with the moon, looking out the portholes, which is another echo for Asal Kadir Kanova's work. Shutapa arrived in 1981 to study fine art at Leeds. I already knew that she was a force to be reckoned with. She wasn't a nervous student. She talked very confidently in her seminars, and I was doing a lecture on what we called theories and methods, which was introducing students then to some of the radical new ideas. And she said, "I love your lectures about feminism, but there's nobody like me in them. Could you get that right by next week?" Many white scholars would say, "But, you know, I never studied anything outside of the European tradition." But I said, the thing about a scholar is you're taught to research, and what I don't know, I have to learn, because I cannot have students who find themselves invisibilized in the work that I'm doing. Post-colonial theory hadn't come in, but obviously it was just at the point at which the Black Arts Movement was emerging in the generation of artists who'd been born in Britain, of parents who'd arrived, but who are now in the art schools and saying, "Here we are, we're British artists." So I immediately had to research how to change the axis of my teaching so that no lecture that I gave would normalize one nation, one ethnicity, one sexuality, one class, one form of bodiliness, etc. She gave me that gift of the demand, and I hope I fed that back into my own teaching, which then was obviously strengthened as the great post-colonial critics Homi Bhabha or Gayatri Spivak started providing us with materials. And there was a wonderful one called Chandra Mohanty, who said, "Any discourse that normalizes the position of the author is going to enact a colonialism." And that was the thing that Chotaba said, that you had to denormalize the kind of blinkered world which was your own in order to recognize how these other worlds were going to crash in, because empire isn't over there and these people have come from over there. It was the entanglement. And so all of Chotaba's work was about the fact that there was a movement over to India and Africa and Latin America, etc., connections all the way around Africa and Africa to India slave trade, as well as the Atlantic slave trade. But there was equally a coming back. And so this set of things that she's made about Lumen specifically evokes two things from the 16th century, which is when the so-called Age of Discovery or these adventurers set out, which is this very rich merchant's house in Bristol, which is where she's filmed it. And the other aspect is that 16th and 17th century Dutch artists were influenced by what came from the world. Rembrandt was fascinated by things from India, and the geographer with his globe, the maps on the back, are all signs of this maritime empire that people would say, oh, this is, you know, domestic scenes by Vermeer or whatever. This is a two-way traffic, but also artists travel on these ways not necessarily as imperializing subjects, but as collectors of the signs of entanglement, but also the richness that came from the exchanges. And that's what I think was really critical. So it's not, I'm just going to introduce notions of imperialism or colonialism or post-colonial critique of colonialism, but actually understand it much more historically and complexly and generatively. Chotaba's engagement with Vermeer, which would seem, no, she's an Indian artist, you know, and she's a black artist. What is she doing with the 17th century white Dutch? But actually, that painting is as much hers. And that's what she also taught me, that artists live in all of the world and everything is theirs to work with. So the image of her mother's wedding sari that evokes the Vermeer painting of the woman in blue, looking wistful, reading a letter, evokes the little Chotaba watching her mother with sadness reading the airmail letters that we used to have. They were a little blue paper and they folded them up. That was the cheapest way to send a letter. But these are the letters that signified the others who were still in Bengal. And her mother was in exile in Britain from her family. She didn't migrate willingly. She catches the pathos that these artists used to charge us in a way that we are going to be affected by the stories of empire. That's sort of, again, in her piece, which evokes the American artist Edward Hopper, as the doubleness of the beauty and the pain.
I know as well she encouraged you to participate in her works. You kind of became the non-centered centerpiece of one of her performance artworks. And she encouraged you as well to engage with artists as teachers. You mentioned the Black British Arts Movement. You invited Lubaina Himid and Sonia Boyce to lecture at Leeds in the 80s. And we talked about their work and the exhibition The Thin Black Line in 1985 in a recent episode of Empire Lines with Professor Dorothy Price at the Courtauld. Could you talk more about your position as part of this network at that time and what it was like working with artists like Lubaina?
In the same sense in which Chotaba says, there was nothing like me in your lectures, could you please change it? Let's repopulate the history of art with people from all over. She also was trying to do a thesis on black women artists, and she said, I need their mentorship because none of you can mentor me on this. She was the one who invited those, but of course I was the one who could say to the university, I am inviting them, but I don't want to take away from that too. But she trusted me, and I trusted her enough that when I was invited to her studio to see her new work, which I thought was so fascinating because I'd be teaching about performance art and happenings, and here she was suddenly doing it, I did not expect to be sat in the middle of the room and have a white hood over my head and be exorcised by some of this ritual around me, and to have to bear the weight of empire and be the figure that she needed to overlay with the charge of her own resources from Hindu mythology, because she would say, as she did in The Great Housewives with steak knives, you know, English women think, oh God, you know, Artemisia Gentileschi and this figure of Judith who's taking the head off a conqueror, this general Holofernes. And she said, I don't need that. I've got Kali. And you have this idea of Asian women as all quiet and simple, etc. But we have a mythology that's a completely different one. So it was learning, but all of this kind of process of our unentangling and decolonizing is a work you do every day. I've talked with Lubaina Himid when we launched Framing Feminism, the anthology of texts about women in the women's movement and art, published in 1987. She's in that. I invited her to be part of the launch, but then she used that as a platform to say, but we black women aren't in the histories of feminism that you're writing, and it's on a recording there. But what's so interesting to me is I was challenged, again, quite rightly, but that we conversed. We talked our way through it, not feeling, okay, I've been attacked and I have to be defensive. So when you say this question of learning, I have always found education not a place of just being challenged by people wanting to get, but to say, we're in this together unevenly, and you have privilege and lecture and all the rest of it, etc. But it's what you do with that challenge that creates an environment in which the students can grow intellectually and artistically. And that's what I don't think has happened. I don't think the curricula have changed. I don't think the teaching methods have changed. I don't think enough people in that situation have understood it means that you do have to take on the position and hear the hard words that are speaking back.
Absolutely. You've spoken before about how the art historian Hagiwara Hiroko was the first to write a book about black British women artists in the 1980s, and that was in the Japanese language. To date, there is still no anthology that exists quite like it. But in the centre of this exhibition of Medium and Memory, the light is shining down on a series of works by Coral Woodbury, who uses Japanese ink to layer women artists, including Joanne Leonard, another artist on display in this exhibition, onto pages of The History of Art, a 1962 book by H.W. Janssen. Tell me about this work in particular and how the artist is engaging with those histories and historiographies again.
I just want to say something about Hagiwara Hiroko, who is just one of the great feminists of the world and has engaged so much with British art and was so concerned to show to the Japanese world that there were artists of colour in Europe. She was part of the de-imperialising of Japanese history, right? Because that's also a society that has its own racism within it. She's just a very, very brilliant and important feminist thinker, who's translated a lot of my works into Japanese, to which I'm immensely grateful to give me a conversation I have there, etc. So Coral Woodbury is one of the artists that I got to know through this particular gallery, Hakobi Gallery, a US-American artist that uses the Japanese painting techniques. And I was so astonished at her project to paint over every page of her own copy that she studied with in the 1990s. As a younger artist, deprived, even in the 1990s, by the normalization of this textbook, of access to women from all over the world. So it's not just, you know, women artists, but it's precisely the sense of the narrowness, and the maybe one or two added to revised editions, but the revised edition is incomplete. And so this project is both an exploration for herself of who are all the women who should be there. But of course she can do that because there's a generation of feminists from the 1970s who have been systematically both going into the archives and recovering artists, but also, like Hiroko, documenting artists. Catherine de Sager went to Latin America specifically for a particular project to do with linking, as it were, Europe with the Latin American in the colonial and imperial pace. And of course, many Latin American countries are the first post-colonial countries, like Argentina was liberated from its colonialism in 1828, not 1928. So there's a very long history of post-colonial struggle there. But Catherine has brought back lots and lots of interesting work by artists in Brazil or Argentina or Venezuela. So artists that we now know about, like Gago, Anna Maria Maiolino, they were hidden inside the patriarchy, inside the Latin American art worlds, and not seen by any. But it's the work of women for the last 30 or 40 years that have built this up, and now suddenly they're taken up by the market, but stripped of all the careful thinking of how they negotiated patriarchy, colonialism, empire, sexuality, gender, in their locations, their own geopolitical situations.
Thank you.
And that work by Schutepa you mentioned earlier on, Housewives with Steak Knives, is also part of an exhibition in London, Tate Britain's Women in Revolt. Griselda, a lot of your work is about how we make white European and Western histories more representative rather than necessarily more inclusive or diverse, showing them for what they always have been. You've curated exhibitions at the Hepworth in Wakefield, you've written extensively about artists like Van Gogh, and you've also got an upcoming book about Gauguin. How do some of the themes that we've spoken about your practice inform how you engage with well-known histories of well-known artists?
That's a very good story. Okay, the book coming forth, which is Griselda Pollock on Gauguin, is the product of an enormous struggle in the publishing world because I gave this as a lecture in 1992. So still developing from the contacts with Schutepa and others. And it was called Avant-Garde Gambits, Gender and the Colour of Art History. And it was at the beginning of a series of works which weren't about representing artists of colour, but actually identifying how the language of colour inscribed a racism into art history. So the famous painting by Gauguin of Manao Tu Pau Pau, of a young 13-year-old bride of his lying naked on the bed and scared, was received in Europe as a black Olympia. So they were using the language of colour as race, and I wanted to expose that is already in the heart of that, and that Gauguin was a colonial tourist. He went to a French colony. The world of Tahar Hamana, the young woman in question, was caught between her own culture and Christianized superimposition of Catholicism. And then this syphilitic man comes, and she got syphilis and eventually died from it, as did her son, who was born to him, whom he abandoned. And these are very real histories, which the great glorification of the wonderful exotic works of God never get to. And I gave this incredibly angry lecture. And when they said they were going to reprint it, I said, I can't have it Griselda Pollock on Gauguin. I've never written on anybody, right? I always write concepts. The titles of my books are conceptual, Vision and Difference, or Differencing the Canon, or the Virtual Feminist Museum. So I write to deconstruct this myth about this artist, whom I think is such an extraordinary fabrication. In terms of medium, this man never would pass into any exhibition of mine. Just a very, very, very bad painter. And nobody will say that out loud because there's such investments. I wanted to bring out that kind of feminist rage, and I can only hope that when people do read it as an indictment of modernist colonial tourism and the sexual abuse that was the condition of Gauguin's access. He had a 15-year-old daughter and married a 13-year-old. Now, within certain cultures, the coming of age at 13 of puberty is marriageable. We obviously think girls should be protected to a higher level of age, so we can't kind of judge it. But still, this is a man with a wife and children, falsely marrying somebody, so she thought she was protected for life, and then off he goes. And again, this entanglement, make it visible to people. There's a corresponding promotion or exploration of the complexity of the artists who are women and how they interact and always were there. But you have to deconstruct the myth of masculinity, of white masculinity, as a normalized figure of the artist. Because that matters as much for artist men of color to negotiate a kind of a pantheon. Instead. So there are these multiple levels of continuous deconstruction of your own ignorance, of your own assumptions, of your own normalization of certain positions, and allowing yourself to be perpetually challenged. In the end, I realized there would be no way that would be republished if I didn't concede on the title that Thames and Hudson, because it would only fit, they could only put two words on the cover. It's agonizing, but now I'm very fascinated with this book, how that will be received now. Maybe nobody's ever read this book because Avant-Garde Gambits, Gender and the Colour of Art History sounds just, you know, far too much to get your head around. It's typical Pollock. Too many concepts all in one go. So we shall see if somebody reviews it and says, God, this is a really strong decolonising thing. When was it first published? 1992? I would like them to see that the encounter with Schutepa and with Lubaina in all the dark years where she wasn't given the recognition as a major British artist that she deserved, and she's sort of getting now, but not with the full depth of understanding of her brilliance. And I think that's what happens, that in the post-colonial to decolonizing era, somebody is admired for a label, whereas they make art not to be labeled, but to put things in the world that everybody has to think about from positions that challenge other people's privilege, their enclosed boxes.
Well, Griselda, I promise you'll always have more than two words on Empire Lines if you'd like to pick up the conversation when the book comes out. Thank you ever so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
My pleasure, and it's been lovely to be with you and to share this exhibition with you.
Medium and Memory, curated by Griselda Pollock, ran at Hacklebury Fine Art in London until the 18th of November 2023. An expanded exhibition of Coral Woodbury's revised edition runs until the 4th of May 2024. Griselda Pollock on Gauguin is published by Thames and Hudson and available from May 2024. You'll find all the links in the episode notes. Empire Lines is produced by Yelena Sofronievich. For more episodes, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.